The reading this morning will be from Numbers chapter 11, verses 16 through 23. The book of Numbers, chapter 11, verses 16 through 23. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. And bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. And I will come down and talk with you there. And I will take some of the spirit that is upon you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you may not bear it yourself alone. And say to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat, for you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, "Who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month until it comes out at your nostrils and it becomes loathsome to you. Because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and you have wept before him, saying, "Why did we come out of Egypt?" But Moses said, "The people among you whom I am number 600,000 on foot, and you have said, 'I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month,' shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them?" And the Lord said to Moses, "Is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not."
No PowerPoint this morning. Although, we're going to spend almost our entire time, and you'll say, "Well, what does that have to do with the scripture reading when I tell you?" But it will. It will tie in, you will see, and it will all work out. But we're going to spend most of our time over in 2 Kings chapter 6 and 7. We're going to go through a story there that has a lot of interesting people, a lot of interesting events in it, and there's a little humor, there's a little action, and as well as some lessons that are applicable to us today, and some themes that show up throughout the Old Testament and throughout the Bible. So, first of all, our main text is going to be 2 Kings chapter 7, but what's the backstory here for 2 Kings chapter 7? I believe it was Randy who gave a lesson on the previous story maybe a few months ago. I can't remember. I think it was. But the part that leads up to it is Syria and Israel are always at each other's throats here. There's a constant back and forth, tit for tat, that goes on between the two kingdoms for some time. And in the middle of a lot of this is the prophet Elisha. And if we start in 2 Kings 6, 8 through 10, it says, "Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, 'At such and such a place shall be my camp.' But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there.' And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him, and thus he used to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice." And the mind, if we go on to verses 11 through 12, "And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?' And one of his servants said, 'None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet, who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom.'" And Elisha's an interesting character, right? He's the protege, if you will, of Elijah. And so much so that he asks for a double portion of Elijah's spirit. And from all the evidence we have, he must have gotten it too, because he's quite a strong character. He's got this immense outsized personality in the Bible. And there's always a lot of people trying to kill him. At this particular passage, it's, of course, the Syrians. They want to kill him. So how does that go for them? Hopping forward to verses 20 through 23 of 2 Kings 6, it says, "As soon as they entered Samaria, They sent an army, and of course this is the famous passage earlier than this where his servant is very worried, and Elisha says, "Look around you, open his eyes up, Lord," and he sees them surrounded by the forces of the Lord, which is the forces that Elisha could see already. And so those forces strike that army blind, and they're led into Samaria, into the capital of the northern kingdom. And Elisha says, when they reach there, Elisha says, "Oh Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Now, we go right from there. It's an interesting way that Kings has of stringing together events, because that kind of sounds like the end of a story, doesn't it? And they didn't come on raids anymore. And the very next verse is, "Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria." So it makes it sound like just right after these events that this next thing takes place. And there was a great famine in Samaria. Now, a siege, as you know, a siege to a city that had walls would really only be in a bad shape when you ran out of food and water. If you ran out of food, that was when it was time to think it through. As long as you had enough food to last, you kind of hung out, you waited the guys outside out, and eventually maybe they got tired. It's a big war of attrition. It was a waiting game. Who could wait out the other one the longest? Which one would run out of resources? And so we have here that there was this great famine in Samaria as they're besieged. And it says here that a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver, and the fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver. So what is that? What are those strange terms? So a shekel is about 2/5 of an ounce. A cab is about a quart. So that means that people were paying about 2 pounds of silver for a donkey's head, which seems like a ripoff. But the worst one is they were paying 2 ounces of silver for a quarter of a quart of dove poo. Dove dung, right? Just a little bit of dove dung, and they were paying this, a fairly sizable and non-trivial amount of actual silver for dove dung to eat. Now, every siege had reached its apex. I mean, you see this over again in the Bible. When you read ancient history, a siege has truly reached its apex moment when people are consuming their own family members. And we go into that point next, right? This is the things get even worse. 2 Kings 6, now 26 through 31. "Now as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him saying, 'Help my lord, O king.' And he said, 'If the Lord will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor? Or from the wine press?'" So the king's already snotty, isn't he? He already says, if God's not helping you, I can't help you. Things are bad, and he knows it. "And the king asked her, 'What is your trouble?'" So he says, he kind of gives that snotty, snarky remark and says, "Fine, okay, what's going on?" And she tells him this terrible story. She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And on the next day I said to her, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. And he said, "May God do so to me and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today." Now, why does he say that? You might say his anger should go out against these Syrians that have surrounded his city. But instead, he's angry at the prophet of God, right? He's angry at Elisha. Now, I think that this connects to the previous story because Elisha has saved his bacon so many times. He's connected directly to God. And now things are bad. We humans, we live in the moment. We can have a moment of stunning success. And then later in the same day, someone can say something cruel to us and it can ruin our entire day. Can't. Have you ever had that happen? Or you go up some high and then you crash down low. And when you're low, it seems like nothing could happen to make anything better. Nothing could possibly be good. And we're like that. We live in this moment, this small slice of time. And so the king, he's in the middle of a famine caused by a siege. I don't know if he's got in his head. I mentioned the fact that there's sort of a hard end to that previous story. So I don't know if this is really that close in time. But if it is, imagine that he has just sent home a chunk of army troops back to Syria at the behest of Elisha. So maybe he thinks to himself, you know, I should have killed those guys when I had the chance. Then maybe this wouldn't be happening. But no, Elisha didn't let me do that. And Elisha's the prophet of God, but he's not helping us now. As he says to that woman who says to him, hey, help me. He says, if God doesn't help you, who can help you? Nobody can help you. We're in a famine siege state here. We're at the point where there's no food left in the city. Nobody can eat. And people start eating their own children, right? So that is the real bottom barrel there. You've reached the bottom of a siege when you're at that point. You really are at the capitulation point. You're at the point where you don't want to admit it, but you almost wonder if it's better to let the enemy in, and you know that's bad because you know the terrible stuff that's going to happen, but you're at the break point. So what does he do? How does this go for him? Already, remember, like I said, other people have tried to kill Elisha. It didn't go so well for them. Elisha is, as I mentioned, I think the common term today almost might be like a Mary Sue or somebody who things bad keep trying to maybe happen to him, but he's impervious to all of them. If you were to use one of the common terms today, Elisha is OP. He's overpowered, right? Nothing really touches him. Nothing gets to him. Okay, so along comes the king of Israel and says, he makes this promise, one of those classic Old Testament promises. May God do so to me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow, Elisha's head does not still rest on his shoulders. And so going on to 2 Kings 6:32, we go now forward into Elisha. It says, Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Now the king had dispatched a man from his presence, but before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold the door fast against him. It's not the sound of his master's feet behind him. You can't sneak up on Elisha. You can't do it. I mean, the Syrians have been trying to do that for years. Didn't work for them. You can't sneak up on Elisha. You can't do anything that even gets near him. He's just like this. This is part of his character in the Bible. So in classic Elisha style, he already knows what's happening before the messenger even gets there. So what's this message, though, from the king? It says, and while he's still talking with the elders, the messenger came down to him, and I had this vision in my head of the messenger yelling through the closed door, all right? Because, I don't know, I mean, he says, hey, bar the door, because here comes the messenger. And then I picture the messenger having to talk to the door like this, right? And the messenger came down to him and said, this trouble is from the Lord. Now, this is a message directly from the king. So this is like the words of the king. So this is the king talking now to Elisha. And he says, this trouble that I have now, this famine, this siege, is from the Lord. And he says, why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Why should I wait for him any longer? You tell me. He's essentially questioning his faith at this point. Now here's where we come to one of the first great lessons here that I want to draw from this passage, okay? This fantastic story kind of gives us an insight into one of the things that seems to happen to us a lot. Your life will get a series of events that seem to really bear down on you. And you're bearing a great deal of weight. And it seems almost like somebody keeps piling on a little more and a little more and a little more and a little more. And you get desperate. There's no escape from this. And day in and day out comes and goes and you think, can it get better ever? No, it gets worse. You get hit with another one and hit with another one. And then when it looks darkest and you seem like you're just about to break, maybe you even go to God in prayer and say, I've just had enough. I'm just done, right? At that point, that's when the sun breaks. Notice here what Elisha answers him. They're in the middle of a famine siege, right? They're about to break. Somebody's going to bust open those gates. The Syrians are going to come in. It's not going to be pretty either. I mean, a famine didn't end the siege. It ended the famine part of the siege, and then the people came in, and then the army slaughtered everybody. So, you know, this doesn't look up from here. There's still more to go. And But Elisha says this to him. He answers to him. And now we're in 2 Kings 7. So now we're going into 2 Kings 7. Elisha says, "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord." Now here this is, you know, that chain statement means this is Bible. All right? So when a prophet said that to you, one of Elisha's caliber, this was like God had spoken it directly to your ear, right? So this is what Elisha says. "Tomorrow." So they're right at the break point, right? There's a siege. They're losing this fight, okay? They have gone into the city. They are starving to death. And Elisha says, "Tomorrow, about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." So, he says, tomorrow, it's going to be done. It's going to be over. This darkness that you think has dominated your life for so long, where you think you're at the break point, he says, God is going to solve that tomorrow. And tomorrow, now you're going to buy food. So we have a bracket here of food prices and food, right? The first one is donkey head and dove poo. And then the next one is 2 types of fine flour, right? And both of those are going to be sold. So you're going to buy 7 quarts. 7 quarts, right? Almost 2 gallons of fine flour for a single shekel, and 14 quarts, twice as much, of barley for the same price. Now imagine that you are there in that place. This is tough for us to do. When we read the Bible sometimes, we read Elisha, we say, you know, you ought to trust a guy like that. I mean, look at him. He's never wrong. You gotta say, fantastic. This is a good thing. But transfer yourself into that time. You're incredibly hungry. And when you go out, even if you're a wealthy person, you look around for what there is to buy, what there is to eat. Okay? And here's this guy. He tells you that tomorrow, you're 1 shekel. That you can't even buy a quart of dove poo for 20 shekels. And you're going to buy 7 quarts of fine flour for one of those tomorrow? How on earth could that possibly happen? It's not just that the siege is going to be broken, mind you, because if the Syrian army just leaves and they take all their stuff with them, you know, they've usually ravaged the land around a city. You kind of did that. You showed up, you hung out, you ate off the good stuff around the land. You made sure that even if the people got out of the city afterwards, it wasn't pretty. So how's that going to happen? How's flour, which is not in the city at all for the taking, going to suddenly be that cheap? And the king would lean on a captain, right? So he's our next character that gets introduced. He thinks the same thing I just said to you, right? And he says this: "When the captain on whose hand the king leaned said to the man of God, 'If the Lord should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?'" He says, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, how's that going to happen? He essentially questions, how could that ever happen? He sees no exit from this situation that would provide that. Even the exit he hopes for, even something like God going in there and, you know, and driving away the Syrians, in his mind, he might think, I'm sure he's heard stories of that, right? I mean, I'm sure he grew up hearing stories of great miracles, but now he wonders to himself, if God even should open the windows of heaven, how could something like that happen? How could that go? And Elisha, see, okay, you gotta understand about Elisha, you never got in Elisha's face. Okay, that was always a mistake, right? Remember the bear story, right? I mean, Elisha is not somebody you messed with. He's just not. There might have been other prophets that you could converse with and say, I don't believe that, but not Elisha. You did not mess with Elisha. And so Elisha looks at him and says, oh, you're going to see it, but you won't get to eat any of it. It's just like a backhand smack. It's just the way Elisha is. He's just a snarky guy kind of that way. Right? Like when they said, hey, going up, you bald head. And he said, oh, am I a bald head then? Yeah, we'll see about that. And calls down bears, right? So, I mean, it's like that's the kind of guy Elisha was. If you questioned him, he was just like, no, we're not going to have that conversation. Right? So this captain says to him, how on earth could that ever happen? That can't happen. And Elisha says, oh, it'll happen, and you're going to see it, but you don't get to eat. Now, that's even crazier, isn't it? I mean, imagine this. You got some cheap flour going on, and the guy's a captain. The king leans on his arm. I mean, assumably, he's like an elite guy, right? And how is it that tomorrow there's going to be cheap bread for the taking, and he, who's a hungry guy, is not going to get to eat any of it? That's crazy talk, So how do these things all fit together? At the moment in this passage in the story, we haven't seen the miracle yet, right? So we're still at the point where someone says, it's like one of those puzzles. You got a guy, he's in a room, it's a little bit of a hot day, there's nothing else in the room, there's no furniture, there's no chairs, there's no nothing. He's hanging from the rafters and he's 8 foot off the ground. He couldn't have jumped up there, he couldn't have climbed up there, there's a puddle of water on the ground, what happened? Right, and you wander around, well, it's a gigantic block of ice, right? See, I just gave it away, I'm sorry. So if you're ever in a thing there, you can know. But so everybody right now is like, how does this happen? How do we get cheap flour for the next day, all right? And then on top of that, how is it that this captain is going to see it and not get to eat any of it? Now, it's interesting to me that the king doesn't say anything here. So remember, he came to kill Elisha, right? So the king kind of, he leaves. Okay, he was there to do a job, and he said, "May God deal with me, blah blah. May it be best for me." He did his little, call down a curse on yourself, swear an oath thing. But because Elisha told him tomorrow it's going to be over, see, I think the king actually has a little bit of trust here. Maybe the captain says, "I don't know, but we'll go wait this out. We'll go wait another day. We'll see what happens." Okay. Now here's another lesson here. Because this is really what the captain does, right? The captain measures the arm of the Lord with his own arm. I asked Dan to read that passage from Numbers because it has kind of the same general tenor to it. There, of course, we have Moses, one of the greats of the Bible, asking, "I got 600,000 people. How are you going to feed them meat?" And God says, "Really? Do you think my arm is short? Oh, this is not going to be a problem for me." God, a lot of times these questions, this passages like this, make us ask, who is God? Who is he? Is he a man like you and me? See, we humans, we try to do things, right? And we say to ourselves, we got to be active, write a little task list, we get stuff done. And then if we need to get more stuff done, what do? We form a big organization. We come together as a government, as a society. And with that society, we might do fantastic things. We might go to the moon. We might say there's no limit to what we can do. We fantastic humans. And then if there's something, though, that comes up that we feel is beyond ourselves, well, we don't go to God with that because we've measured his arm with our own. We said, "Well, that's, my arm's about that long, so your arm must be about that long." We measure God's arm with our own arms. And several times in the Bible, God uses that phrase, right? Is my arm really too short? I don't really like, ESV goes, is the Lord's arm shortened, right? I kind of like it when one of the more blunt hitting ones says, is the Lord's arm too short to do this? Who do you think I am exactly? Who are you talking to? By the time Moses talks to him, he's talking to a God who has split the Red Sea so that these million people can walk over it, right? So they've already seen that. But as humans, we have such a tendency to forget that last part, to forget that, and then say, well, how can you do the new one? Remember that the disciples do this to Jesus, right? After he's already fed the 5,000, they get confused on the second time and go, how are you going to do it? It's like, were you here? You guys ate. Don't you remember that? We humans, we forget this. Yesterday is yesterday. Even if we had a great success today, oh no. Now we doubt him. Now we measure his arm with our own. How long is your arm, God? Can you really reach me? You're far away. Can you really reach out? Can you really do that? We measure his arm with our own. And that's exactly what the captain does. The captain's a Jew. He's been brought up. Well, he's an Israelite. He's not a Jew, actually. Sorry, Northern Ten Kingdoms. So, but he's brought up, theoretically, he's heard stories of the greatness of God. He lives in a time where miracles are done. Elisha has gotten his master out of scrape after scrape already, right? And so, but he doesn't remember much of that. No. At this point in time, the captain now asks, how is that possible? Even if God were to do this great thing, he can't do it. He questions him. He measures God's arm with his own. And he's wrong. I love the next part here. So there's a lot of humor in the Bible. And the interesting thing about the Bible's humor is sometimes it's a dark humor. And we don't want to admit that because it's a little bit, you know, I mean, we're in a siege situation. We just heard a story about people eating their kids. And then you get this great little, like, vignette stuck in here, right? So 2 Kings 7, back to 2 Kings 7. And then we'll look at verse 3. Okay, start back in verse 3. Now, there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate, and they said to one another, "Why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, 'Let us enter the city,' the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. So now come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live, and if they kill us, we shall but die." So they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. But when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come against us." So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. And when these lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent and ate and drank. They carried off silver and gold and clothing and went and hid them. Then they came back, and they entered another tent, and carried off things from it, and went and hid them. So you get this great story. This is one of the best. This division, the stuff is so drawn so nicely for us. You got these lepers, right? They can't go back in the city. Nobody wants to touch them. Nobody wants to deal with them. They're lepers, right? We know how lepers are treated in the Bible. And so they say, "Well, but we don't want to go back in the city anyway. I mean, I don't want to eat dove dung, do you?" So they say, at this point in time, "I want to go. At least the Syrians, they got food, and if they kill us, well, we're going to die anyway." And so they wander over there. There's nobody in camp. Nobody in camp. Now, what's interesting to me here is, why is there nobody in camp? There's nobody in camp because it says here, the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army. You know, look, don't take this the wrong way, but that's a weak miracle. That's a small one, okay? So the captain doubts. He doubts. This is not this. You know, this is not stopping the spin of the planet Earth and rotating it backwards. This is not a flood that deluges the entire planet. This is not stopping the entire sun moving in the sky while you conquer your enemy. Those things had already happened, right? This is an auditory hallucinatory response, right? I mean, God basically sends them a sound, and what happens is the Assyrians all leave. Now that is going to create what? A supply and demand issue, right? Because now all the flour and everything that's in the Syrian camp is going to come into the city. And thus we get cheap flour, right? So thus we see prophecy number one that is about to come true. So here we have the idea that the captain has doubted. He has doubted God, but he's doubted him for no reason at all. He's doubting him for no reason at all. God didn't even have to hardly lift his finger. I had this view in my mind in this passage of God. It's like he had to expend such a tiny, pathetically small amount of effort. And everybody worried. They said, "We're in this famine. How could anything go differently? How could anything change? We got the Syrians here. They hate us. They've been hating us for years. They'd love to break in the city gates. We are almost done. People are eating their kids. That's the end of siege. That's the end of it. It's time to open the gates, right? It's time to let the slaughter begin and then flee out and hope you live. Hope you live. Hope that they take you prisoner instead of killing you." And so you're at the bottom of your rope. You're at the bottom of the barrel. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. And so, but at this time, right, we see God. It's like I said, I imagine him at his desk, and somebody finally comes up and says, "Hey, Samaria's under siege." "What? Oh, yeah. Sound of an army. Okay, I got to go back and do this important stuff," right? Because it's such a trivial miracle, right? It's just this. Like I said, it's the sound of an army. Now they're scared. Hittites, Egyptians, leave. So it gets even a little bit funnier, right, before we're done. It says, these lepers, right, they talk to each other. They say, "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we're silent..." See, I picture them as just rotund now, right? They have just eaten their fill, okay? And they're sitting around like this, and they've plundered a few tents. Not many, right? It's an army out there. They don't, you know, there's a couple of guys. "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we're silent and wait until morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now, therefore, come. Let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "Hey, we came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they were." Then the gatekeepers called out, and it was told in the king's household. And the king rose in the night and said to his servants, now this is what the king's phrase is, right? Does he say to himself, "Yay, Elisha told me that this was going to work out this way"? No, he doesn't. He says, "You know what? I know what those Syrians have done. They know that we're hungry, Therefore, they've gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, when they come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city. Now, that was actually a pretty common tactic. If you've ever read the Iliad, right, so there's this give and take between the army that laid siege to Troy and the Trojans, right, and every so often the army would pull back and try to make it look like they'd left, and the Trojans would come and sally out, and then they would come in for the attack, and then they would go back in the city and they'd close it, right? So this was kind of pretty common. So the king says, hey, they're just pulling a quick tactic here. And it says, one of his servants says, let some men take five of the remaining horses, seeing that those who are left here, so remaining horses, right? I mean, there's a lot in this section about food. They've eaten the rest of them. And so he says, let some men take the remaining horses, okay? And seeing that those who are left here will fare like the whole multitude of Israel who have already perished, let us send and see. So they took two horsemen, and the king sent them after the army of the Syrians, saying, go and see. So they went after them as far as the Jordan, and behold, all the way was littered with garments and equipment that the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. The whole path is complete. They're like, they're running away so fast, they're throwing off stuff. Get the armor off me, I can't run fast enough. Those Hittites and Egyptians are coming to get me. I mean, theoretically, I guess God probably followed them with the sound. They probably figured, we are just dead, we're dead. And so in their mind, in their hearts, they heard that sound. It wasn't just to complete it, it struck fear into their hearts. And so these army soldiers who were winning that war, by the way, they're completely casting off stuff, they're doing anything they can do to get out of that town as fast as possible. And of course, this leads to a great plunder of them without any work being done by the Israelites. So he says, and the messengers returned and told the king, then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Syrians. So a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Word prophecy number one. No more donkey heads and dove poo. Tonight we eat like kings. Now, 2 Kings 7:17, second half of the prophecy, right? So we got the first piece. That's how that happens. The king had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gate so that he died. Well, sure they did, right? The excitement of that. They trampled him in the gate so that he died, as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. Prophecy number two, fulfilled. Just like that, within one day. Within a 24-hour span, and Elisha says, what? You're coming down here to kill me? Okay, fine. Tomorrow, this is how it's going to be. You're going to complain. You're going to see it, but you won't eat anything of it. Classic Elisha. Done. Quick. Easy. Right? Why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? It's like Peter getting out of the boat, walking across the water, and he starts to sink. He cries out, Lord. And Jesus is like, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt that? Part of the time between you and me, the water was hard, like it should never be. And yet, for some reason, you doubted. You looked at the waves, you looked at the things around you. You didn't stop and think, I'm doing this on water, right? No, I feel like that's what we would do, is I'm doing this on water. But as humans, we don't do that. Instead, we look out and we say, ah, and we start to sink, right? And that's what's happening to them there. They start to sink. They look around themselves and they start to sink. Now, God could see all these events, and Elisha could, through the word of God, see these events as well, and knew what was going to happen, and yet they doubted him. So all of this is fulfilled by a single event. All of it's fulfilled by the Syrians hearing the sound of a marching army coming after them, and then bing, 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 and we're finished. We're done, right? Story is over. Right when we start to doubt, when the darkness seems greatest, then it seems like God comes for us. And then what's funny is, isn't it common for us to say, oh, yeah, I see that now. Now that all makes good sense. You know, it's one of those things. Do you watch Hercule Poirot ever? Right, Hercule Poirot, he doesn't like to tell people how he knew how the mystery was solved, right? Because when he tells them, they go, ah, is that it? Really? Oh, that's easy. No, it's not. Right? It's God. It's not easy. It's not easy for you. You measured his arm with your own. It's not something you could have done. That captain, he's in the military. He's in the soldier. He's a soldier. The king leans on his arm. But he can't achieve this. It took God to achieve that. If only he had faith and only he had trust. We, as humans, I wrote down, let's stop being astonished by God. Let's stop asking, how can this be? But we are humans, and we're never going to stop asking that. What we should instead realize is that when it seems darkest, tomorrow, you might not be eating dove poo. I put that way on purpose because, you know, maybe you'll remember it. right? Maybe you'll remember that the next time things are really seeming dark, you'll think, you know what? Tomorrow, maybe I won't be eating dove poop. Right? Just think that to yourself. Because maybe the Lord's deliverance comes. He comes because we are his children. He comes and delivers us because he loves us. I want to plant the invitation here. I'm sorry, I've gone a little long. So we're going to sing a song in a minute. And at that time, there's going to be an opportunity for anyone who has a need from the church to come forward. What need do you think you could have? You know, it's an interesting thing, but notice the king doesn't come to Elisha and ask him for help. Have you noticed that? Look back at the story we just read, and the king comes to Elisha looking to kill him. He doesn't come and say, look, can we possibly go in prayer together to God? Right? I'm tired of being hungry. No, he says, I've had enough, and I'm going to kill Elisha. I am done. Right? So instead of asking that, though, so we have a tendency to do that. Well, we're going to handle this question ourselves. God apparently isn't listening. But yet, that's because we're measuring his arm with our own. We're measuring his arm with what we can do and what we're capable of. There's another place where we end up with that phrase. It's in Isaiah 59, 1 through 2. Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, or his ear dull that it cannot hear. Okay? But, he says, but your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. So that he does not hear. And it's not that the Lord's arm is too short to save you, but there is a gap. Those who have sin in their life who have not been forgiven by Christ, there's a gap between you and God, and he does not hear. It's not that his arm is too short, it's that he does not reach out to save you until you are a child of his, until you've put that on in baptism. If you're here this morning and are not saved, then listen, you're separated from God by your iniquity. His hand is not too short to save. You have to understand that this is a God who carefully crafted precisely a situation over thousands of years where every prophecy spoken of in the Old Testament was fulfilled concerning his own son and his coming and the fact that he would die and rise again for your salvation. That is the kind of God that we worship. That is what his arm can do. It is infinitely longer than yours. That is the kind of God we serve. Do you think his arm is too short to save you? It is not. It is not too short. If you need him, and he can save you, you need to reach out and grasp his hand. It's like he's right there. You ever thought that? Imagine that. He's right there. That's how long his arm is. It's like he's right there. Tomorrow, you won't be eating dove poo if you reach out and take the hand of God. If you need to do that, you need to come forward now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected.